This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Peoria's airport manager is not a fan of President Trump's proposal to privatize air traffic control.
The places where they have privatized air traffic control, the amount of aviation that occurs in those countries is probably about equivalent to the amount of aviation that occurs in Illinois.
Hear from Peoria Airport Director Gene Olson about the dangers inherent in air traffic control. Charlie Schlenker has the story. Colleen Reynolds tells you about the McLean County Diversity Project and the students who will see history firsthand this summer at the Auschwitz Nazi death camp. And GLT's John Norton previews an upcoming show at the Castle Theater with St. Paul and the Broken Bones. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 6th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. President Trump has proposed privatizing the air traffic control system in the United States. Gene Olson is the director of the General Wayne Downing International Airport in Peoria. He's not a fan of the idea, though in this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Olson says it's not a new proposal.
I don't think you'll find too many airport managers that would be in favor of it. It really consolidates power and puts too much power in the hands of the airlines. The latest proposal that I've seen has a board that would be in charge of it, and too many of the seats are in the hands of the airlines. They would get to make all the decisions about what gets funded and where it gets funded. So you would see a consolidation of services and facilities in large communities and big cities. It's just not a good idea.
Well, that would certainly take away from really small places. The rural West would be greatly affected, but would there be a difference for places like Bloomington Normal and Peoria?
Yes, it would. I mean, the trend is already that way. You know, they're talking about consolidating TRACONs, which is a terminal radar approach control. And right now you got Moline, Springfield, Peoria, Rockford. They all have TRACONs, and they're talking about consolidating all of those into two facilities, one in Chicago and one in St. Louis. It's just a terrible idea. You're putting all your eggs in the same basket so that if something bad happens, either a natural disaster or, as we've seen in Chicago recently, man-made disasters, you're putting all your eggs in one basket so you can take them all out with one shot.
As you said, this idea is not new. Is this iteration more or less likely to succeed where others have not?
I think this is the first time I've seen the White House behind it. I believe Congress has, there are definitely differences of opinions within Congress about whether this is a good idea or not. You know, I think the problem is that FAA has some procurement issues. So they have difficulty in rolling out large-scale programs. And projects. And privatizing the system is not the answer to fix those problems. They talk about a stable and predictable stream of funding. Well, if you look at FAA appropriations, they've gone up almost every year. The problem is not going to be fixed by privatization. The whole point is, who pays for air traffic control? And the airlines would like to shift a large portion of the cost away from themselves and on to corporate and general aviation. The way to look at that is to say, okay, we've got an air traffic control system. What drove the construction of the system as we know it? And if you take general aviation completely out of the picture, if you could wave a magic wand and eliminate general aviation, what kind of air traffic control system would you need? Well, you'd need essentially the system that we have today. Now, if you took the other course and you could wave a magic wand and get rid of all the airlines and just have general aviation, then what kind of air traffic control system would you need? Maybe 20% of what you have today. So who should pay for that system? You know, the users of the system should pay for it, and they by and large do. And the biggest users of the system are the airlines.
How would the current proposal shift costs in terms of fees?
Well, they've talked about all kinds of fees for service, and that would be, you know, like filing flight plans and things like that. Anytime you tie a fee to usage of the system, you're discouraging use of that system.
Well, Congress people need to get to Washington and back to their districts. Is this likely to have liftoff in the House?
If you had asked me that before the last election, I would have said it would probably be DOA. After the, you know, the last election, I couldn't predict it. But I know members on both sides of the aisle that I know more people that are not in favor of it than I do that are in favor of it.
What would consolidation of service look like?
You know, like, for example, they consolidated and sort of privatized the flight service system recently within the last few years. So it used to be that, you know, there were lots of flight service stations at airports all across the country. I know there was one in St. Louis. There might have even been one in Peoria, but I'm not positive about that because I know there was a weather bureau here. You could walk up and look at a weather map and have a briefer give you a briefing face-to-face. Then in about probably the early to mid-80s, they consolidated flight service stations so that there was one in each state, basically. And everything was being done over the phone. Then they took the flight service station system and they turned it over in a private contract to Lockheed Martin. And there's basically one in Washington, D.C., and it's terrible. You know, pilots don't like using it. As an airport, that's who we have to file notices to airmen with, and we don't like it. You know, we don't use that system anymore. We actually participate in the system where we file notices to airmen directly on a computer. And that was developed because flight service was so terrible to work with. The places where they have privatized air traffic control, the amount of aviation that occurs in those countries is probably about equivalent to the amount of aviation that occurs in Illinois. You know, people would stop using the system. So if I know that every time I key up the microphone, I'm going to have to pay a charge for talking to an air traffic controller or more likely for filing a flight plan, I'm just going to not file a flight plan.
How much less safe does that make everyone?
Well, in the IFR system, instrument flight rule system, where you're talking about poor visibility, it's a lot less safe. You know, if it's a good weather day like we're experiencing today, most pilots are probably not. You know, they're choosing, am I going to fly IFR and be in the system, or am I going to fly VFR and just not be in the system? In other countries, access to aviation is restricted either by the government or by the economy. When you try to fly in Europe, it is tremendously more expensive than it is flying here. Here in the United States, the rules are just different. So the rules that overseas have been designed to, you know, regulate flying so much that people just don't do it. You know, like everybody points to Canada as a success story for privatization, but, you know, the amount of aviation that occurs in Canada is nowhere near the magnitude of what occurs in the United States. And partially it's population, and partially it's the rules that are set up. You know, I think what it boils down to is, you know, the airline lobby has found an ally in Bud Schuster, and they're pushing, you know, harder and harder to try to get this passed. And, you know, I just don't see where, you know, there's a benefit. Fix FAA's procurement issues. You know, if you go out and look at the population, well over half the American population thinks that privatization of a publicly owned asset is a bad idea. And to me, this is an economic development issue also, because if the airlines are going to control how the air traffic control system is deployed, then it's not going to be a system that grows.
Gene Olson is the Peoria International Airport Director. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
On the way, it's another installment of the IPR series, Veterans Choice, Making It Work. And John Norton talks with the frontman of St. Paul and the Broken Bones, playing the Castle Theater tomorrow night. I'm Mike McCurdy. The McLean County Diversity Project, which includes students from 6th through 12th grades, usually takes a summer trip. But this year, that trip is not necessarily something that will generate cheery Instagram photos. WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with Suresh Krishna, a scholar and chaperone who will be traveling to a Nazi concentration camp in Auschwitz, Poland. U-Hi student Oscar Urquizo is also joining on the trip. They'll be joined by a Holocaust survivor who was subject to the gruesome and often deadly experiments of the notorious Dr. Joseph Mengele. Krishna says the trip will probably be more impactful than the other trips the group has taken.
Based on the history of the place we are going to visit, we are visiting an extermination camp where a lot of people were, based on religion, were treated the way they were not supposed to be treated. It's one of the gruesome incidents in our history. We're not going for a vacation spot like how we did in the previous years. We're going there to see how people were treated, and they had no reason to be treated the way they were treated.
Oscar, you have been on previous trips, and I know there's always an element of those trips that involve history and diverse populations or social justice, but this is pretty different.
This is very different, yeah, especially because we're going to be going with Eva Kaur, so an actual survivor. It's going to bring a very emotional aspect to all of us, just to see where she is now and then like what she had to go through and the different things that happened to her in this camp.
Have you done your research on Eva Kaur and know a little bit of her story?
Yeah, actually I have. We watched a documentary about her, and so, you know, it was kind of interesting to see, you know, when you look at her now, you wouldn't think that. I mean, the video talked about how she was a real estate agent when she came to America. And, you know, you never think about those things. You never think about if the person that's selling you your house was a Holocaust survivor.
And she really has an interesting approach to her experience, right?
Yeah, she wants to forgive. And that's very hard.
Suresh, have you learned a little bit about her? And what are your thoughts about traveling along with someone who actually survived the horror that you're learning about?
Initially, sometime last year, the decision was made that we're going to be traveling to Auschwitz. That's the point I started my research on, and we were told Eva Kaur is going to be traveling with us for the trip. So I did a lot of research on Eva Kaur, and we got a book that she had written, Surviving the Angel of Death, which got her whole experience throughout, from where she was with her parents, how she got separated, and day by day what happened. And Eva Kaur being with us to tell us the life stories that happened to her will really help us to connect what we have read. And there's some misconception in the community, even at work when I talk to people, some say these are like made up stories. So when we have a person who underwent this whole, the way they were treated, and when she gives us stories of explaining the room of hair and the room of shoes and the room of abandoned luggage and the cattle cart that she was exported on and the platform where she was separated from her parents, the last time she saw her parents. So these are going to be really, you know, emotional, as Oscar mentioned, and we need to know these things and keep these memories alive so that we can talk about this and prevent it from happening, because we are all humans. One time or the other, anger comes out, and anger and hatred are, Eva tells in her book, anger and hatred are the seeds for germinating war. So when we talk about this and make sure that this doesn't happen again, visiting these places is really good. I mean, I don't say it's good, but it's emotional. But we need to know what is the reality so that we can share this with our kids and in our community and see that with whatever, knowledge we have, make sure this doesn't happen in the community where we live in.
Oscar, I don't know about you, but I was just surprised hearing Suresh say that he has coworkers who question that the Holocaust occurred.
I was thinking about that too, because for one of my final projects at school, I was required to analyze a film. And so recently, for the diversity project, we watched Schindler's List. We were supposed to figure out what parts of the film were real and what parts were, you know, Hollywood mock-ups or makeups. And there was a lot of things in there saying that none of this existed and that Oscar Schindler was not the person they said he was to be. So that's why I thought it's pretty interesting that we are going to be going with Eva Kaur, someone who is actually there, someone who's going to tell us the truth. So that way, that's the thing that you don't get in the classroom by watching films, not having that second source that can prove that everything's correct.
Suresh, what do you say to those coworkers who are raising questions? I'm kind of surprised. Where do you work?
I work at State Farm, State Farm Insurance Company, Corporate South.
And you have people there questioning whether the Holocaust occurred.
Really, yes. Yes. So if it was like 2 years ago, I would have believed them that it might not have, would have happened. But after researching for the whole 1 year, and now I know the facts. And with after the trip, for sure, I'll have more stories to tell to them that what had happened. It's left to people. I mean, seeing is believing. That's what many people think. Since if in history, whatever happened, for example, there's an article written by one of the scholars. And as we were talking throughout this year about the Holocaust and Auschwitz, the same time, Holocaust was being discussed in school. So the scholar says the teacher touched upon Auschwitz but did not go into a lot of details. The student says it's not sure the teacher was knowledgeable or was not willing to accept that these incidents really happened. So with that context, the knowledge in the community about our past and the history, it shows how much we still have work to do to educate the people now living in the community and our children, and so that they know what has happened in the past and prevent bad things from happening in the future. So Diversity Project has given a very good platform, at least for the scholars, based on my involvement from 11 years and what I've seen students are called as scholars in the project, how they grow and their thinking process and how they open up and understand things. And once they graduate, they take all this knowledge and go to whichever community they live in, and share these memories and make the community where they live in a good place to live in, so that people are treated well without being discriminated with race, color, or religion.
Oscar, how do you absorb all of this in light of what's happening around the globe today?
And it's interesting to look at how Eva's idea of forgive, because in the films we've watched and the things we've analyzed before and the interactions about how other survivors don't like Eva's idea of forgiving, they all kind of think she's crazy. But it's quite frankly working for her to help cope, and it's helping her make a difference by opening the Candles Museum and things like that. So it's, if you think about it, forgiving may not be a bad thing.
That's GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talking with University High School student Oscar Urquizo and Suresh Krishna, a chaperone for a trip to see Auschwitz, where more than 1.1 million people were killed during World War II. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Veterans Choice is a federal program intended to reduce wait times for medical appointments. We continue the IPR series, Veterans Choice, Making It Work, by hearing from the people these benefits were designed to help. Susan Stevens has more.
At least once a week, Lisa Ditzler drags herself out of bed much earlier than she'd like to and heads to a parking garage in downtown Rockford.
Oh yeah, I got a full load today.
Ditzler volunteers to drive veterans to the VA hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. It's a 75-mile trip each way and an all-day commitment. The service is coordinated by the Winnebago County Veterans Association and delivers an average of 100 people a month to their appointments.
Morning, sir.
Morning.
How are you? You are...
Jeff
served as a Marine in Desert Storm. He spends a lot of time in the van to Madison. Those long-distance VA hospital appointments could be replaced by care from local doctors under Veterans Choice.
Veterans Choice? What is it?
Too many veterans are still unaware of the program that allows them to visit a local doctor if they live too far from VA services or can't get an appointment within 30 days.
I think I got some kind of letter about it, but it seemed like I always get my appointments scheduled up in Madison when I need them. So.
Hey, Chris.
Hey.
Chris is another regular on the Rockford to Madison van. The Navy vet from Loves Park has brain cancer and needs the specialized care the Madison VA hospital offers. But he also uses Veterans Choice to get less serious medical issues treated locally.
Work in progress, but it's gotten better since I've joined. I've been there for, been doing this for about 10 years.
John Klein is the man behind the Vets Van service to Madison. He's the head coordinator, working out of his little office in the basement of Rockford's Memorial Hall to make sure drivers, riders, and paperwork all are where they need to be at the right time. He works with a number of local vets organizations to try to make sure veterans know their health options.
The feedback I've got from most veterans that I've talked to about it is that they're afraid to use it because they're afraid that they'll go to a private doctor and then get stuck with the bill.
From what I'm getting from the folks that provide the services, they're afraid that they may not get paid in a timely manner. So both sides have this fear about payment.
That's Dave Davis. He's commander of the American Legion Post in Rockford. Like John Klein, Davis wears a lot of hats in different veterans organizations. Other Vietnam vets open up to him about their concerns with Veterans Choice. Some say they can't get it to work for them. Others are thrilled with it. So Davis, who has other medical insurance options, gave Veterans Choice a shot so he could understand the system better.
Well, 6 weeks later, I still didn't have an appointment. I'm going, this is weird. So I called up Veterans Choice. That place won't accept veterans anymore, so we sent it back to VA clinic. You got to start all over again, Mr. Davis. So it's been a total of about 4 months ago now, and I still haven't got that appointment.
It's the eve of the Vietnam National Convention at a hotel in Crystal Lake.
How long has Veterans Choice been in existence?
The organization was founded and is still headquartered in Rockford. Naturally, the mix of men and women, service members and spouses, gather in the hotel bar, though most are sipping sodas instead of the hard stuff. You will not find a bigger fan of the Veterans Choice program than Al Hoagland, Rockford. Instead of driving 80 miles to the Madison VA Hospital for an eye appointment, they found an ophthalmologist 4 miles from his home and scheduled everything for him.
A piece of cake compared to an ordeal of going all the way up there and back down again. And I found a better doctor. I'm not saying they have bad doctors there, but I found an exceptionally competent doctor.
Mary Tendall is the go-to expert on PTSD for Vietnam and a speaker at the convention. She says that in the rural area of California where she lives, more veterans in their 60s, 70s, and 80s are finally getting the treatment they need. She credits Veterans Choice because the vets don't have to travel so far for medical services. And many of them were afraid to set foot in hospitals run by the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Because they've been fighting for any help they can get from day one when they came back. So I think there's more to it even than just the medical.
And while some don't trust the federal government with their health, others are afraid Veterans Choice is the first step toward privatizing all health care for veterans. Sandra Davis of DeKalb chairs Vietnam's Agent Orange Herbicide Committee and is married to a Vietnam vet.
The more people that use their civilian doctors, the less we're going to have VA facilities. I think that the veterans have earned the right to have their health care.
Meanwhile, vets are reminded to make sure they get their Veterans Choice card before they try to use the program. Follow the rules. This is the military, after all. I'm Susan Stevens.
Tomorrow, hear from those who are trying to help those veterans navigate their medical options. That's part three of Veterans Choice from IPR tomorrow on Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There are some illnesses that humans struggle with that can affect our pets as well. Diabetes, arthritis, heart disease, to name a few. Perhaps one of the most heartbreaking illnesses is one that's also difficult to pin down. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of GLT's Animal House.
There's nothing unusual about growing old, but it is unusual when our faithful dog goes to the linen closet to be let outside rather than the back door. When our beloved pets start exhibiting behavior that is eccentric or confusing, it can be a sign of senility. Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal believes senility is becoming more common due to the fact that we have better care at our disposal. So, our pets are living longer.
A lot of the pet care that's out there, a lot of the investment, emotional and financial. In healthcare, we're seeing some animals with significant intelligence and cognitive ability get into some older years. And it's just inevitable that if nothing else breaks down on them, eventually we may see some stuff in their brain break down.
Is this genetic in the dogs, or is there something going on with their lives that is outside of them that is causing this?
I don't know that there's been any genetic attachment proven to this syndrome as much as, again, just to some of these animals. There has been some research into preventative measures, which are really not that difficult to do. And a lot of things dietarily. When we tell you to put your pet on fatty acids when they're 3 years old, a diet with high-quality fatty acids, or when we're looking at certain quality diets, there isn't fixing it once it starts. You can't. Maybe you can slow it down. If you see that your pet's starting to develop senility or dementia or whatever you'd like to refer to it as, and then decide it's time to institute some dietary therapy, you're probably not going to affect the process. So one of the arguments for looking into certain dietary changes early on, sort of natural anti-inflammatory diets early on, is to try to make this brain stay as healthy as possible.
If we do see some early symptoms of this, do you feel that there's basically nothing we can do in order to slow it down, and certainly not to stop it?
Well, it's interesting. Part of it is just figuring it out. At what point is an old dog who's deaf and less responsive? And we're going to focus this discussion a little bit on dogs. And if we go through the places that senility or dementia, cognitive disorder, when you look at the places that it most obviously manifests on a day-to-day basis, it's easy to see why cats may be getting it as much as dogs, but the cat's lifestyle sort of is preventative for the kind of changes we see.
What are those changes?
There's a handful. Disorientation. One of the classic signs we'll see in dogs is when it's time to go outside.
They'll go to a kitchen cupboard rather than the back door.
Exactly. They'll go to the hinge side of the door versus the doorknob side of the door. And that's usually a corner, and they'll sit there and kind of wonder why the owner's not letting them out. Well, there's a habit. The owner picks that up because they're letting their dog outside. Cats don't need to go indoors and outdoors. So a lot of cats' behaviors are restricted to indoor activity. Dogs are used to telling their owners when they have to go outside, going to the door to let them know they have to go outside. And this is one of the places where we'll see some behavioral breakdown, both in how they acknowledge that they need to go outside, or another sign is not going outside anymore, sort of not realizing that they're urinating, or we call it poop dropping sometimes, where they're not actually positioning to have a bowel movement. But if they're pushing upstairs, for instance, they'll start dropping feces on the stairs as they're going up.
So that's an early sign.
It can be. Now, again, we'll see some dogs with significant spinal and pelvic arthritis who become poop droppers, but they're totally fine mentally. They really just are starting to struggle a little bit neurologically in the back end, but their brains are fine.
Well, what are some really definite signs that it's senility?
Along with some of the breakdown in typical behavioral habits in the house, interactions, some of these animals will either become more withdrawn, and again, dogs have typically a much more social element to their profile than a cat does. They become a little bit more withdrawn. They can become a little bit snarkier, more cranky, sometimes aggressive with
they
handling.
Could bite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where they may seek petting behavior and then snap when they get that petting behavior. One of the things we see fairly frequently that is, I think, is one of my favorite signs for senility.
I love the way you put that.
One of the things, when an owner mentions this, we immediately start thinking, oh, okay, let's discuss some other things. And again, you'll see why this is more obvious in dogs and cats. Cats are nocturnal. They're typically can be very active at night and sleep all day. Dogs will often become these dogs who are starting to get senile will sleep all day, and then they're very anxious at night. They're pacing, they're panting, they're roaming the house. And we often hear about this because that's an extremely disturbing sign, obviously, to the owners who are trying to get sleep. One of the things that we do to address that a lot of times is turning on lights, because we sometimes wonder if the animals are getting a little panicked in the dark. They're struggling with just typical cognitive process, and then the dark does not help that. So, and if they're deaf on top of it, a lot of these older animals are deaf which is a benign change. But when you add that sensory withdrawal, that we withdraw that sensory from the element, and they're still, you know, trying to think things through. So we'll sometimes leave lights on throughout the house. One thing that certainly seems to help is really buckling down on scheduling, feeding exactly the same time in exactly the same place, doing the indoor outdoors exactly the same time, exactly the same place, trying to take as much thought and prediction process out of their general cognitive day as possible. And activity levels generally, but again, how do you measure activity level in a 16-year-old dog? Of course, they're going to be less active. So that one can be a little bit difficult until you start seeing activities that are odd. Pacing, sometimes these animals will get up and wander into a corner and just sit there and head press into a corner.
That's so disturbing to see.
It is, it is. And many years ago, actually, this drug's been out for a while, a drug called Anapril, came out specifically for cognitive disorder. In our experience, the results have been very mixed in using this drug. We're certainly willing to pull it off the shelf and give it a shot when we see some of these animals that are starting to sort of become debilitated, really causing a problem.
Does it really help?
Well, if you look at the Anapril studies, it's great. And then if you look at the some of the more referral level studies, mixed results. And then I know we were sort of disappointed early on when the drug first came out. But we will still reach for it on the shelf every once in a while. I think that it should not be the silver bullet, though. Much more important is a little bit of in-house husbandry and management. Keep in mind, these animals aren't suffering. They aren't suffering, which when it progresses... And it isn't always just senility. For instance, the greatest, my dog of dogs, Hobby Hobbs, he began to break down mentally. And it was getting pretty concerning to me. And I ended up taking him up to a great neurologist in Chicago, and we MRI'd his brain. And I expected him to find like a big grapefruit in there because of how badly he was, you know, declining mentally. Physically, totally fine. And it had turned out that he had additive stroke events. And you could see where the stroke events were. And each one of these strokes had just knocked out a little bit of his ability to function. I was fortunate that I had access to an MRI, that I could afford it, that I was in the field, so it probably wasn't as expensive for me. You know, we can't just send anybody up for MRIs to figure this out.
Yeah.
And at what point, my technician, her dog passed away in the last several years, going down the same path, but then dramatically dropped. And I just had a very close friend who went through the same thing, where we were certain that this was not just senility. These dogs presented as senile, but rather quickly began declining into a much more organic decline, where we didn't do MRIs on either dog, but we really didn't have to. What we were seeing, we knew that there was either medicine, one dog a likelihood of metastatic brain cancer, the other dog probably just a primary tumor in the brain from the way they're acting. But it does get complicated. And so there's this whole menu of things that can create dogs' senile changes. Benign senility, this is one where we're just, best thing to do is really structure their habits with feedings and letting them in and out. And then at night, if you start seeing them being restless in the evening, trying to do things to give them something, quote unquote, mentally to hang on to. Lights throughout the house. Not in your room, of course, you guys need to get sleep, but having lights throughout the house, if there's a favorite place they like to sleep and they can hear, sometimes having some sort of sound on, music or radio or anything. Well, and also going back and making sure, is it just senility that's causing them to leak urine? There's a lot of things that can cause animals to leak urine when they're older. Senility is one of them, but there's a whole slew of things, arthritic conditions, physiological conditions, more when we say organic neurologic. This is an organic disease, senility is. We think there's protein deposition going on up there, but that's not as aggressive as multiple stroke events or a space-occupying mass. So all of these things can contribute to what we feel is senility in dogs. In cats, again, when you just went through that whole list, cats are typically more active at night. So it can be hard to pick up a cat that sleeps all day and is roaming all night. That's what most of them do. House soiling. Cats are so tied into litter box and texture related.
It can be anything that would set them off to not use their litter box.
Exactly. And it takes a lot to get them out of the box. They don't have to have a lot of their brain going for mm-hmm. them, you know, to be drawing it, because that's a habit they create. They're typically having access to food all day. Older cats' activity levels can drop a lot. They don't have a habit that needs to communicate with owners about in and out. So it's not that cats don't get this. In our field, we rarely feel that we are presented with a cat where the primary complaint from the owner is they don't know what's going on anymore. The cat doesn't doesn't know what's going on anymore. And in fact, we take a bunch of those off the true senility shelf because we'll end up finding that their hearts are beginning to fail or there's something more organic going on. And their emotional and mental decline is secondary to this primary disease.
So if it truly is senility, is this something where we have to basically make the decision to put our animal down, or can the animal live with senility?
Great question, because this really is one of the most difficult euthanasia situations we're presented with. When we euthanize our pets, I use the term want here, obviously, in directed towards closure, not towards, yay, we get to euthanize our pet today. The want is that you feel the relief that you're giving your animal when you humanely euthanize. Bone cancer, end-stage organ failure, advanced neurologic disease, where when your dog's seven or your cat's seven, you get sick at the thought of humanely euthanizing them. And then when you finally see something start eating them up and taking them away from you, you really feel the closure and relief. These senile dogs, or what I went through with Hobbs, with the multiple stroke events, is they're horrible because there's no pain. There's no suffering. You're just seeing your pet become a shell of what it was. And there comes some point where it is entirely fair to that animal to let them go, even though they're not in pain or suffering. When you see your animal, you know, looking normal when they're in repose and sitting there, but when they stand up, their face plants into the ground and they're looking at you like, why can't I get my face off the ground? Or if the entire human companion animal bond relationship is one of where you're every day thinking, should we do another day of this or should we humanely euthanize? Should we do another day of this? We always tell our clients this. When you get to a point that every day you're wondering if that's the day you're going to put your pet to sleep, it's time to put your pet to sleep, because everything that is about that human companion animal bond is gone at that point. But it can be extremely difficult to go through this because of the fact that there's no true pain or suffering involved.
Except your own true pain and suffering.
Exactly. And no decent pet owner wants to put them in front of their pet when they make this decision. In a sense, we kind of always are. But it's also the veterinarian's responsibility to hold that client's hand and say, hey, we're going to get through this, and we're going to tell you when it's okay and it's not okay, and to be very blunt and very honest. And I think we're very good at that. That is certainly a huge resource for trying to get through a euthanasia decision where there isn't outright pain or suffering in your face.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. Maybe you'd like to add a pet to your life right now. If so, consider the Animal House Pet of the Week. It's Vinny. This 8-year-old domestic short hair sports a natty tuxedo coat, a classic black and white that goes with anything or anyone. Vinny is a sweet fellow with a laid-back approach to life. His needs are simple: a catnip mouse, an occasional back scratch, and a warm human to snuggle. You can find Vinny at the Humane Society of Central Illinois. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a pet-related question for one of our Animal House team of experts, you can post it at facebook.com/WGLTFM or email it to news@WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to St. Paul and the Broken Bones on Sound Ideas. The gospel-tinged soul band St. Paul and the Broken Bones makes a stop at the Castle Theater Wednesday night. GLT's John Norton talked via Skype with frontman and songwriter Paul Janeway. He said his reading of the book Just Mercy by Equal Justice Initiative founder Brian Stevenson played a role in the direction of the band's latest album, Sea of Noise.
You know, I read that book and it had this really profound impact on me where I almost was like, you know, what do I need to be doing with this? You know, what do I want my legacy to be? And being from Alabama, being from, you know, the Equal Justice Initiative, which Brian started, is based here in Montgomery, Alabama. So I was like, if I'm going to write a record, these are the things that are moving me. You know, you can kind of see a reflection, or at least your perspective of a reflection of kind of where you feel like, you know, personally and maybe where the country, I guess, as a society, where it's starting to kind of head, and there's bits and pieces of the past that kind of come into that, and just trying to navigate what it means to be, you know, be from where I'm from, what it means to, are we trying to seek out love? Is there a possibility of that? You know, it's just a, it was just an interesting kind of journey. So the record had a lot to kind of discovering that and navigating through that.
So is it race relations? Is it the divide between the rich and the poor? Or is it just about loving each other, like you're saying?
It's all of the above.
Okay.
And that was what I didn't realize was such a heavy task with the record. And I didn't realize I was writing it.
Build it, fist and look good while everyone is slinging mud. Jesus found his politics, but nobody listens.
Well, and you threw the church imagery. As a matter of fact, the album cover itself has church imagery with, you know, it hints at the gospel nature of the record. So are you tying, you know, social justice, equal justice in with religion as well?
Okay. I think there are definitely times where it's I've never understood why social justice and things like that. It's, you know, such a buzz term now, but I've never understood why it's politicized. I've always thought that the fundamental roots of, I would say, all religion is some sort of taking care of your neighbor and loving your neighbor and things like that. And I think it's always been bizarre to me. And the idea, it kind of gets lost in the noise. It's like trying to find the essence of things and trying to find what is real. It becomes more difficult. We're all connected, but we're not really connected. People, you know, people don't have, I mean, even at concerts, people have to watch a show through a cell phone and not have a genuine, real experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we're just at a weird place. And it was such a, I didn't realize while writing the record that it was such a heavy task and so weighty when I was writing it. But it was like, I have to write what I feel. Because if I don't, I kind of lose interest. I would probably quit doing this if I quit doing it that way. And that's kind of what happened.
Let me ask you this, Paul. Once the album was written and maybe recorded, did you find some of the answers maybe that the questions you had going into this? Or was it sort of cathartic for you? Are you a different person coming out after having done this album?
I think so. I mean, I think for me, I the story that I don't tell too often, but I've said it in the past, I really, after going through kind of all this with the first record, you have this identity crisis where you go, you know, now you've had a little bit of success or what's perceived as success, and you go, then you have to decide, do you really want that? You know, I kind of am who I am. You know, I'm not... I live a very certain kind of lifestyle where I'm pretty boring, and I don't, you know, I don't know if that's something that, you just kind of go through. Do you want this to define you? I vividly remember thinking about quitting and had my letters all written and was going to talk to everybody about quitting. And, you know, my wife obviously was like, you know, you can't do that. You know, you really love doing this. You just need to find what you need to come back to what you really love about it. And so writing the second record, kind of doing what I wanted to do, I think is the thing, and writing what I wanted to write instead of being worried about it, that kind of changed me, and that's how I'm going to approach it from here on out.
Is it the way that I move?
It's interesting you mentioned the boring part. Have you are you familiar at all with the history of Rush, the band?
Oh yeah, there's that great documentary about.
Yeah,
it.
I just got done watching that about a month ago, and those guys ran into the same problem, you know, when at the you know, on tour, they were back in their hotel rooms reading books, and everyone else is out there doing drugs and drinking and getting stupid, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, it is, but that is me. I'm going to get in the tour bus and you know, maybe hang out with the guys a little bit, and we just talk about the show, but I'm usually going to get in, call my wife, and read a book. I mean, it's just not, and I don't drink, never have, and it's an interesting lifestyle for me.
Yeah.
It would probably not be my first choice. but I love doing it, and I love playing music, and I love performing, and so it's like, it's this weird thing, but you just realize you just do you. And screw the rest, really.
Well, let's go to the soul music. What has caught a lot of people's attention is young people that have really latched on to this retro soul, the 60s and 70s soul sound. Leon Bridges, Michael Kiwanuka, Charles Bradley. Well, Charles Bradley's not young, I guess, but you know, his new music sounds like something from the 60s and 70s. Where is this love of classic soul coming from?
I think it's obviously something there. I think the idea behind it for us was, you know, we have a pretty strong history in the state of you know, Muscle Shoals and the Muscle Soul sound, you know, the Swampers and things like that. So for us, it was a situation where we were like, the first record, we were like, oh, that's, let's see if we could do it like they did it, because that's music I grew up with and I didn't really know any better. I mean, it's true. There's algorithms now for hits. There are people out there who have an algorithm to be like, all right, well, let's put this in and this will be a hit. And it's like, so everything is sounding so vanilla and so and just like you're hearing the same song over and over again. And I think when with soul music and really, like, you know, soul music especially, though, is so raw, and you can't hide behind certain, you know, modern tools. You have to sing. The live performance. I mean, nothing is, everything you see on stage, everything you hear is being done on stage, and that's a big deal. And we've done a ton of festivals, played around the world. That is not very common, which is kind of sad to me.
Paul Janeway from St. Paul and the Broken Bones is joining us here on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. You guys are, you know, you're a high-energy band, both in studio and you know, in concert, but there's a song on this album, the new album Sea of Noise, that just knocked me on my butt, and it has nothing to do with high energy. Is It Me?
Oh, yeah.
That song, you know, you mentioned Muscle Shoals. It almost sounds like something that could have been recorded down in Muscle Shoals back in the day.
Yeah, it's that song to me is a that's actually one of my favorite songs probably I've ever written. That's a really special song for me, especially for the record, because it is the bow on top. It's this song that it deals with a sci-fi novel that also deals with the idea of Southern identity. And what's beautiful is we do it during the show, and we do it really stripped down. You know, we do it with just the guitar and horns.
Gone's how they smoke behind the dogwood trees. All the bars are closed right before the county line. Oh, how that breeze smells like honey from a bee. Is it head? Is it home? Or is it me?
You know, this is kind of a sweet lullaby kind of song. That's one of my favorite songs I've ever written.
Jesus is stuck inside my TV screen, giving all the answers, but never holding me. Heaven's too far away, and I can't find no peace. Is it hell? Is it home? Or is it me?
So you mentioned how boring you are in real life, but, you know, on stage you're almost a maniac. What are you, sort of like one of these football players who is just like meek as all get out off the field, but then, you know, all your whatever you need to get out, you do it on stage?
I think for me the idea is that it's therapy for an hour and a half. It's my release. It's always, music's always kind of been that way for me. There's like a switch that goes off, and I have a personality, you know. I'm definitely a personality as far as a person, but I'm just not. I'm not that. I think some people think I probably do some sort of chemical enhancement on my brain. You know, it's funny because when people go, "Oh, you're influenced by soul music and all these things," and while that's true, there's also like some Iggy and the Stooges type stuff there too. That, like, there's a little more punk rock element to it. And which is always kind of funny. It's a funny mixture.
Well, keep doing it because everyone's digging it so much. Paul Janeway, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Janeway with St. Paul and the Broken Bones spoke with via Skype with GLT's John Norton. You're listening to Flow With It from the band's Sea of Noise album. St. Paul and the Broken Bones play the Castle Theater in Bloomington tomorrow night. You can hear more of this album on GLT Blues Radio at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find John Norton's interview at WGLT.org. Find the complete show podcast and all of the individual interviews, thanks to Charlie Schlenker, Laura Kennedy, and Colleen Reynolds at our website. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.